call 22-1326, Christian Fenneco, the City of Philadelphia. Mr. Crane, how are you,
sir? Your Honor.
Am I pronouncing your client's name right?
I'm sorry?
Am I pronouncing your client's name right?
Yes, you are.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge. May it please the court, I've reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal. My name is Larry Crane, and I represent the appellants in this case, which tests the right of a municipality to selectively punish personal off-duty speech by employees on issues of admitted public concern.
Where's the selectivity?
The selectivity is in the basis that we cite to statements by the highest command within the police department that they are
That's
not...
the deputy commissioner, right?
The deputy commissioner Patterson, who said that we're not concerned about left-leaning posts, and God help you if we find a post based on a pro-life message.
All right, but the only thing you've appealed is the First Amendment retaliation claim, right?
That is correct.
So how does that fit into the First Amendment retaliation claim,
well,
the selectivity?
It certainly goes to whether or not it's the sole motivating factor on the basis of whether or not they chose...
So it goes to, I didn't understand you, goes to what?
Goes to the question of whether or not in this retaliation case, the content of the speech was the sole or at least a motivating factor for the discipline imposed. We believe that the proof will show absolutely. In fact, I don't believe there's much dispute about that.
Isn't the real threshold issue here whether the district court correctly decided this at 12B6 as opposed to letting it go to discovery?
Absolutely. In every case we found, and I've been doing this kind of law for quite a while, every case that I have run across or tried involved a record, at least.
What about Craig?
Pardon me?
Craig, the Seventh Circuit case with the guidance counselor in the book he wrote. Are you familiar with that case?
I'm sure I've run across it, but, Your Honor, I don't have present recollection of the facts of that case.
It was decided on a motion 12B6 because the thoroughness of the pleadings and the attachment of the requested document gave the reviewing court all it needed to have before it to determine as a matter of law, and it's a legal determination, how to evaluate the Pickering inquiry.
Well, the problem, Your Honor, please, is there's
Reebok,
no...
I think it's no Reebok. There's another one from the Ninth Circuit. Same situation. Reebok.
Yeah. In this case, though, the court applied a per se disruptive test. In other words, it just simply said, based on the facial content of the material involved, we find that it is per se disruptive.
Well, but that is not necessarily incorrect, is it? I mean, I would agree with you that in many cases, and maybe even here, it would have been cleaner to go the Rule 56 route. But that's not what we have. That's not what the district court did. So my question to you is, because we are confronted with a complaint that was dismissed at the 12B6 level and a complaint which explicitly indicated what the statements were by the officers, what facts would you produce in response for a Pickering kind of balancing to be conducted? What did the district court not have to reach what you believe would have been a correct result?
Well, in all the cases in where there is a developed record and there's an opportunity for discovery, the issue turns...
But that's the question.
Yeah, that was not my question.
I'm
giving you an opportunity to say, you know, if the district court was wrong and shut you off from that route, what would you offer in the course of discovery conducted for purposes of summary judgment that we don't have now?
I would offer evidence to the effect of whether or not there was a significant likelihood of disruption and whether or not that was the reason that the city made the decision it made.
Isn't your pleading, don't you concede the fact that there's a likelihood of disruption and fault the city for not waiting until there's an actual disruption? You rely upon an argument that the city did not wait for an actual disruption but look to the fact that there may be a disruption in your allegations, and you argue that's how the court violated the Pickering balancer.
Bear in mind, however, Your Honor, these posts, many of them had been up for many, many years, as many as 6 or 7 years, without the slightest hint of any disruption or likelihood of disruption.
But does that alter the fact that the city may be concerned? And the disruption seems to me that's in large part the argument here, but I'm really more concerned with the violation of the policy, the social media policy and the code of conduct policy, in in and of itself, isn't that enough?
No, it is not.
Why isn't it?
It is not because it does not take into account the constitutional interests and balancing that must be applied to those policies.
But that's a legal inquiry, right?
It is a legal inquiry.
So where did discovery get you?
But exactly. But with the exception of obscenity, perhaps, there's no body of speech which on its face must be constitutionally determined as offensive on its face.
But isn't the threshold here, the gateway, so to speak, is the employer's reasonable fear of disruption? The actual disruption is really not on the table. Yeah. It's the employer's reasonable fear of disruption.
Likelihood.
Right.
It must be a reasonable suspicion. It must be based upon facts.
A reasonable likelihood, isn't it?
Well,
I mean, isn't that what we said in Waters?
From the employer's perspective.
It can't be based on speculation, may it please the court. The Supreme Court in Waters has said that.
I thought your complaint basically concedes those facts which the district court could look at and determine, and as a matter of law, how that weighs out in the Pickering balance in terms of the employer's right to take the action it did to enforce its policies versus the employee's right to speak on a matter of public concern. They're conceding it's a matter of public concern. That's not disputed.
It's not disputed. But in looking at the four corners of the complaint, can you say that the complaint concedes that the city was reasonable in its likelihood or forecast?
Well, no, you're not going to concede that in the complaint.
Right.
Well, we wouldn't be trying to get themselves in the conceded that.
Exactly. So I submit that these officers who have dedicated themselves, someone taking a bullet for the city, have dedicated themselves to the service of the city, are at least entitled to an opportunity to conduct full and reasonable discovery before held to account for a post they made 7-8 years ago.
Are all the officers similarly situated?
All of them, with exception of the level of discipline imposed. Some received suspensions.
Really? What about Officer McGough? Didn't the district court actually, I don't want to say single him out, but in her opinion, in the analysis, actually described Officer McGough's situation as being somewhat different from the others? These individuals are not fungible, of course. I think on page 16 of her opinion, the district judge expressly acknowledged that McGough's posts could be deemed to more closely concern matters of public interest.
The judge did draw nuances between the various plaintiffs with regard to, she didn't buy, in other words, the city's argument or concession on public concern.
McGough lost, but I threw that back at you because you suggested that it was only in terms of the discipline imposed where there were variations. And it seems to me that here the district judge did see some variation in terms of the severity of the actual conduct or posts and any animus that was displayed.
I agree, Your Honor. I think, and for that reason, there shouldn't be a one-size-fits-all for what each plaintiff should. In other words, all the plaintiffs were, of course, denied the opportunity for discovery or to present this court with a record.
What's the record look like? What's going to be in that record that the district court needs to rely upon to make a legal ruling that cannot be gleaned from taking the complaint allegations at face value and assuming they're accurate?
At a minimum, in the record, there would be depositions of those higher-ranking officers within the police department. There would be...
What would they say? I mean, what is it? There'd be depositions and all that good stuff. But what would it add qualitatively to the legal inquiry the district court has to undertake under Pickering and Connick?
Whether indeed there was a reasonable likelihood of disruption or impact upon the public perception of the police department?
You expect the chain of command at the Philadelphia Police Department to take a look at these posts and say, this was all good and there's no reasonable likelihood of disruption in light of these posts. That's what you would need, right?
That's what we think we can get is with respect to some of those posts, and particularly those on the
opposite
end. Some of
those posts are all of those posts. Well, it's a zero-sum game here, right?
Well, I don't want to speak for the fact that there may be some plaintiffs who would survive that scrutiny.
So they're not similarly situated.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think that in this case also, when presented in a deposition with some of those posts which are on the opposite spectrum of the political spectrum, and those decision makers, policy makers who made the decision to fire these people, look at those and say, these are acceptable. For what reason? Well, there's a heckler's veto here taking place by this outside public interest group.
You do get into a heckler's veto kind of consideration, but here you've got a different situation when you look at the nature of the employer, the employee, and the employment, and you factor into that the codes of conduct. I think it's 6.10 of the codes of conduct, the social media policy the city has that I think you'd agree the city has a right to enforce.
Right? Absolutely. Absolutely. I just have a problem.
But it has a right to enforce it. What more do they need to enforce it than what's alleged in your complaint?
I'm just saying that in the enforcement of that policy, the factors that need to be taken into account are whether the officers are off duty, whether they're identifying
policy
themselves.
Policy says it doesn't matter whether they're on duty or off duty. You act as an ambassador of the department, and you maintain an obligation to do that and maintain the respect of, not exactly these words, but basically, conceptually, maintain the respect for the badge and for the uniform and for the city, whether you're on duty or off duty. There are other parts of the policy that say that what you do off duty does not represent the city of Philadelphia. Clearly that's there because somebody in the solicitor's office wanted to make sure that you can get response superior or minimize the possibility of it. But there are still ambassadors under the city's policy.
Absolutely, but they do not forfeit when they pin on a badge. They do not forfeit their First Amendment rights.
Well, that's the conclusion. I'm not so sure. We don't have First Amendment rights when we take the oath of office. Don't they, in fact, forfeit some First Amendment rights by virtue of their duty as police officers and what that entails?
Their free speech rights are not coexistent with those of a citizen on a public sidewalk.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that you can restrain their speaking on issues of national concern solely on the basis of the content or viewpoints expressed. And that's what we're saying took place.
What about this Policy Directive 610? It reads, personal use of social media has the potential to impact the department as a whole, as well as individual members serving in their official capacity. What do we make of that?
Well, I make for the fact that there have been 7 or 8 years where these posts were up and there was no impact.
But again, is that the threshold, actual, or is it the potential as the employer sees it for disruption?
The problem with the sliding scale of what is potential and what is reasonable is the fact that there must be some factual basis to support that, and there must be a fact-intensive inquiry, as this court has held, into those factors. And there has been none in this case, and the plaintiffs have been deprived of the opportunity to do that.
Well, 610 prohibits the use of ethnic slurs, personal insults, material that is, this quoting, material that is harassing, defamatory, fraudulent, or content that would otherwise not be acceptable in a city workplace.
In a city workplace.
Right.
And I would submit that if this speech were to take place in the context of a city workplace, it would be a different scale, a different evaluation that we're looking at.
But somehow the megaphone of social media mitigates that concern or alters that interest. Isn't there greater potential for that megaphone to cause the disruption that the test is concerned about than if it's simply said in the workplace, where there would be more control over what is said and over the speaker?
I think the court should draw a distinction still between speech that occurs in the workplace, which is in the context of working relationships with their officers.
But again, well, that we can get into that in terms of what the impact is. Could reasonably be anticipated to have within the workplace, given the multi-ethnic nature of the city police department. But what about Article 1 of the Code of Conduct, conduct unbecoming? Section 1, Section 021-10 says, conduct which allows for discipline is based on, quote, any incident, conduct, or course of conduct which indicates an employee has little or no regard for his or her responsibility as a member of the police department. Now, you can argue the language as a member of the police department restricts it to while they're on duty, but the entire scope of that is clear. And when I mentioned earlier the officer's duty to act as an ambassador for the police department, that they carry an obligation to maintain and uphold the dignity of the police department, which is a very high threshold, it seemed to me. Whether they're wearing the badge and uniform, whether they're in plain clothes, whether they're at bowling one night after they go home and they're no longer on duty, don't they?
I see that I'm out of time. I'll answer Your Honor's question as best I can. I think the actions speak far louder than their words here. They actually did, for those many years, put sacrificially their lives on the line to act and were honored, given medals of honor for their commendations. These officers upheld the conduct of a police officer, and conduct unbecoming is, let's admit, a catch-all when the city doesn't have specific grounds.
Is there a distinction to be made between an officer who posts in his or her posts, identifies themselves as a member of the police department, and somebody who does it without such a reference?
There's absolutely, I think, an important constitutional distinction between the two.
And you have both examples in this case, right?
We do, in fact. Yes, we do. We've cited cases in which the officers or government employees clearly identified themselves on their social media, and those were consequences that bore out in the facts.
Could the city be, do they have a right to be concerned, given the nature of social media, that whether or not the poster identifies himself or herself as a police officer or not, once it's out there in the media, social media, the neighbors and friends and associates know whether or not there's an identification attached to the post or not. They know that that's a police officer. They have reason to suspect based upon the name.
So the alternative then is to ban all social media when you become a public employee. You have no social media.
Probably not a bad idea, actually.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Do we have the jurisdiction over that?
You do. You're from Altoona. You can do anything.
Good morning, Your Honors. Megan Burns. I'm here on behalf of the City of Philadelphia, appellee in this case, and we ask that this court affirm the district court's judgment. As we've discussed in opening argument here, that police officers are held to a higher standard.
What about the threshold question, as Judge Restrepo framed it with your adversary? Wouldn't it have been, if not more appropriate, more helpful to all of us if the district court had taken this Rule 56 route to summary judgment, and we had a more fulsome record with respect to each of these 12 plaintiffs?
I understand your question, Your Honor. I don't think it would be helpful. I think some of the discussion between Your Honors up here, it would only be marginal. I'm not sure what other facts they would need to show. We already have a sufficient factual basis.
Counsel's represented to us an argument that he thinks that the upper echelon of the chain of command would say that there was no potential for disruption, given the fact that, look, these folks had been, these are 6-7-year-old posts, and there was no disruption. And in fact, some of these folks were recognized and commended for their service. What do you make of that argument?
So, Your Honor, I'll talk about the age of the posts first and the fact that there was no disruption, so to speak, between, you know, some of the years where they posted it and then when it was found out. I think that the disruption occurs when the public finds out about these posts, and it's disseminated not just on a local level, but it's disseminated on a national level through several news outlets. So I don't think the age is a relevant factor, and once you see the posts, the vast majority of them are just as caustic in 2012 when the earliest posts were as they were in 2019.
Then you get into the heckler's veto that Mr. Green is concerned about. There's some merit to that argument.
Correct. So in appellant's brief, they do talk about the heckler's veto and that the perception of the public shouldn't be taken into consideration. But I would submit that because police officers are the quintessential public-facing entity, you do have to consider the views of your audience. We rely on the public. The police department relies on the public's cooperation in order to assist in investigations, to have legitimacy when they're out patrolling the streets to keep them safe. So I reject that notion that heckler's veto is relevant here. And I would add that the heckler's veto argument specifically has been rejected in the Monroe case, which is a Third Circuit case.
That was developed at summary judgment after a full record.
Correct, Your Honor. I would submit, and our argument is that there is a sufficient record on this case based off of the undisputed nature of the posts and the fact that there are parts of the complaint as well that talk about the disciplinary process as to several of these officers. I would like to add, going back to the heckler's veto, that the heckler's veto was squarely rejected also in the Craig case, which your honors had discussed earlier, and then also Meltzer, which is the NAMBLA case, and Bennett, which the Nashville Metropolitan Government. It's a case that was litigated by my opposing counsel, and the site for that is 977 F3rd 530.
Is there a distinction to be made between folks that identified themselves as Philly PD and folks that didn't in these posts?
In this case, Your Honor, I don't think that's a distinction that matters, because what actually matters is the fact that the posts came to light and each officer was identified as the officer making that post. So even though they meant for it to be private, there's always a chance when you're posting on the internet that these posts will be found, and that's exactly what the Plainview Project did. I'd like to go back to the...
Certainly, let me just follow up on your answer to that last question by Judge Restrepo, because there certainly is going to be a difference in terms of public reaction, right? If they know that the particular post is attributed to an officer representing himself or herself as such, as opposed to one that's strictly anonymous.
Correct, right? Yes.
And isn't that, more than anything, what the city's concerned about?
The city is very concerned.
The public's reaction to what a police officer is doing, qua police officer.
I think that's entirely relevant, Your Honor, if that's what you're asking me. The fact that people are seeing the role of a police officer, you know, they are outed as a police officer, even though they might have used a nom de plume or anything on their Facebook post. I think the public would be very concerned that the fact that their police officers are posting things that advocate violence against
but,
the
but
people.
But certainly the intention of the speaker, if you will, is entirely different if they have represented themselves, if he or she has represented himself as an officer, as opposed to someone who has posted and relies upon his or her anonymity, right?
Correct.
It alters the intention of the poster, right?
Right. I don't think that the actual intent of the poster matters in that sense. I think that what the context of the post is, you have to read it based on the four corners of the post itself. What you put out to the public and what you say, there's no unringing that bell. You take that risk that when you post something on the internet, people would misunderstand it and misconstrue it. And whatever these officers' intentions may have been, if they were joking, using humor, that's not exactly what came across here.
So it may be that a reliance upon anonymity as opposed to an intentional invocation of one's position as a police officer is simply not relevant. Doesn't matter. Is that, I mean, that, as I understood Judge Restrepo's question, that's what it was. Is there a difference? Does it matter?
And
if I'm reading you or understanding you correctly, it doesn't matter. It does not matter.
It does not matter in this specific case, because at the end of the day, they were discovered to all be police officers, no matter what their intent or their intended anonymity was. So that is our position. I'd like to talk about the allegations that the city was selectively pursuing the police officers based off of political viewpoint. Here, there's no evidence, and there were no facts pled that the officers were actually targeted.
Well, no, that's why he's arguing it shouldn't be a 12B6. He wants the opportunity to develop that.
Right, but there are no facts alleged in the complaint that viewpoint discrimination actually occurred. I'd like to talk about the comparators that they had put in their amended complaint. They never pled that the police department actually knew about those posts, and in fact, many of those posts post-dated the Plainview Project database being published. I checked on the internet the last time I checked the Plainview Project post was in 2019. That was the last time I believe Plainview had updated their database. And then these comparator posts, I'm not sure how appellants came across it. I'll take them for their word. That's what you have to do at this stage, at the pleading stage. But these posts talk about like COVID-19 themes. So it's clear that the majority of these posts post-date what was the Plainview project. Had those comparator posts been in the Plainview project, we might be having a different conversation, but that's just not before this court, and the police department made its decisions based on the database that was the Plainview project alone. We, the police department, when they get complaints in, it's a complaint-based inquiry. So there was no...
Would that be another reason to let it go to discovery?
No, Your Honor, because they simply haven't alleged any facts that actual viewpoint discrimination occurred. The police department received these posts. They were published nationally, caused disruption. That's actual disruption as well as potential disruption. And that's what they had in front of them. That's how they made their decisions in this case, based off the disruptiveness of the Plainview Project posts. Whatever Plainview did in order to cull the posts or what sort of selective bias they may have had is not relevant to what was before the police department and how the police department made its decisions in this case. Do your honors have any other questions?
I just looked at the Plainview Doctrine website, and you may well be right in terms of when it was last updated. I can't get anything more out of that.
Right. That's just me speaking. It's not in our briefs, Your Honor, but just as a matter of my own personal investigation. I'd just like to end with, you know, each officer had a legitimate and obvious basis for their posts. A lot of them, you know, what is overlooked in this case is that a lot of these posts were violent. It's not just run-of-the-mill, covert, or overt.
When I say a lot of, you're suggesting there's a difference among the various plaintiffs.
There are differences amongst the plaintiffs. I don't deny that. But each officer definitely had posts. All officers, except for maybe one, had posts that celebrated violence, or even worse, celebrated violence at the behalf of a police officer. So
what about the one? So they're not similarly situated.
They're similarly situated in that, you know, each one of these officers...
They all posted something.
They all posted something, and their posts were not protected. Each one had a post as a matter of law.
And I understand your position to be that they all posted, and all of those posts were demonstrated animus of some kind. They don't have to actually specifically invoke violence, do they?
No, they all don't. Right, that's so, just one flavor of disruptive speech that the city was concerned about in this case. And if your honors have no other questions, I will cede the rest of my time and rest on my briefs.
Thank you very much.
Your Honor, as I perceive the defendant's argument, it is that there's an akin to strict liability for anything that one posts on there, even relying on their anonymity, that if you post something on your social media that is susceptible to anyone taking offense, then you have violated their conduct policy.
Well, but it's got to be a reasonable fear, a reasonable concern about someone taking offense, or a reasonable belief that's going to lead to disruption.
I submit that in today's climate, one can take offense at any speech. And it's demonstrated
well,
time and again.
You can have this speech, you might be able to make the argument better. But you, seems to me, based upon the record before us, it's hard to argue that this was just amorphous kinds of stuff that is kind of everyday conversation, and the city was irrational with its concern.
But the highest and best purpose of the First Amendment and the protection of free speech is regarding controversial speech. It's allowing debate on national topics.
But we're in the Pickering universe now. We're not in the John Peter Zenger universe.
I'm sorry, sir?
We're not in the John Peter Zenger universe anymore. This is the Pickering universe.
First Amendment. Correct. But in the Pickering analysis, even within that scenario, to come back to Your Honor's earlier question about the heckler's veto, this is a case, if you look carefully at the setting of this case, there was an outside interest group, Judicial Justice, Injustice Watch, I think is what it's called, that went after officers in eight cities across this country and targeted those posts which it found selectively offensive, and then published that in a database. Now, had that not occurred, we wouldn't be here today, because those posts have been up for, as I said, many years. So is that not the very spirit and meaning of a heckler's veto, which this court has said?
Burns is right in citing to Craig's discussion of that, because until that happened, there was no reason for the city to have concern, did not know about the violation of the codes of conduct and the social media policy. It can't do something about something that it does not know about.
And this court, I think it is the Seventh Circuit Craig case, which said that allowing the public with the government's help to shut down unpopular ideas that stir anger is not permitted under the First Amendment. And that is precisely
Craig,
what
Craig upheld the firing. The teacher's firing was upheld in Craig.
Right. And Craig involved, I believe, a high school district. So unless there are further questions.
What do you make of Ms. Burns' argument with respect to the comparators?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What do you make of the city's argument with respect to the comparators?
Comparison?
Comparators.
As between the 12?
And different sorts of speech.
I think that there are different forms of speech that are at issue here, but that does not get to, there's not a general prohibitive category of speech that is always on its face going to be found offensive. In other words, I think the court decided this case in a vacuum, and you can't do that under a Pickering analysis. It's a fact-intensive inquiry. And so to say that certain speech is offensive on its face and therefore will never be protected under a Pickering analysis is simply not the law. It never has been applied that way. It was in this case.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.